Was a section of Through Birds, Through Fire from bassist Chris Lightcap's new album, which features his band Super Big Mouth. It's a combination of two of his existing bands, Superette and Big Mouth, so the collective personnel there is Chris Cheek and Tony Malaby on tenor saxophones, Jonathan Goldberger and Curtis Hasselbring on guitars, Craig Taborn on keyboards, and Gerald Cleaver and Dan Reeser on drums. Chris Lightcap is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content on burningambulance.com and improve the podcast. So become a subscriber if you can. Chris Lightcap is a guy I've been aware of since the start of his career in the late 90s when he was playing with Whit Dickey on the album Transonic. He was also a member of guitarist Joe Morris's quartet with Matt Maneri on viola and Jerome Dupree on drums at first and Gerald Cleaver later on. That group made three records in the late 90s and early 2000s and then reunited for another record 4 or 5 years ago. Lightcap has bounced around and done a ton of projects in the last 20 years or so, as you do, but he's been leading the band Big Mouth with Cheek and Malaby and Taborn and Cleaver for about a decade now. They've made several records together that are a kind of avant-garde groove jazz. It's hard to describe, but it's a lot of fun to listen to. Superette, which just debuted last year with a self-titled album, is more of an instrumental rock outfit. They even cover a Link Wray tune called Ace of Spades, which we talk about a little bit in this interview. We also talk about writing and recording, about free jazz, and the kind of porousness of boundaries when you're an open-minded listener and player, and a bunch of other things. So we should get right into it because there's a lot to listen to and think about, and it's all pretty interesting, at least I hope so. I'm going to play another piece of music now, which is Queenside from the Super Big Mouth album. And right after that, you'll hear my interview with Chris Lightcap. So, let's start by talking about Superette, which is a fairly new band for you. What was the genesis of that group and the idea behind, and what was the idea behind it?
The idea behind Superette, I don't know if it was such a, in just big conceptual idea beyond the fact that I wanted to do a band with guitar players, and to just write with the sound of the guitar in mind. And I was talking to Curtis Hasselbring, who plays in Superette, about this idea for a band that would be relatively straightforward, that we could both write for, because Curtis is one of my favorite composers that I've worked with as a bass player, and he's a good friend of mine. And we were just kind of spitballing ideas, and I sort of just sounded him out about it one day when we were at the playground hanging out with our kids together. And he's like, "Sure, that'd be great." And so we talked about different guitar players that we could. I said, "I think I want to have two guitar players," and I usually just start with. I usually start with people in mind, but in this case, I was starting with the guitar, the instrument, and then but then as soon as we got to that point, we thought about okay, who are the people that we'd think of, and Goldberger was one of the first people we thought of, and Dan Reeser was the first drummer that I thought of doing it with because he's a drummer that I'd worked with years ago, playing both jazz gigs and rock gigs and singer-songwriter gigs, and I was always looking for a chance to work with him again. And so we just got together and it sounded great to me and it was really fun. And we started off by doing a couple covers that I did arrangements for. And I started writing for the group and then Curtis started bringing in some music as well. And it just kind of came out of that.
Yeah, the album, I mean, it is more of an instrumental rock record to me than a jazz album, you know, in
Yeah, I
quotes.
mean,
So was the writing process different?
Not really. It just my, a lot of my points of reference, though, for the guitar go way beyond jazz, as I think they do for most people of my generation. And I'm, whether you're talking about West African music or 60s garage bands, psychedelic music, just rock and roll in general, which is kind of the music that I started playing before I got into jazz, and the music that got me really excited about music in general and wanting to just be obsessed with music as a fan and then as a musician myself. And so much and then all the changes that the jazz went through when melded with rock, a lot of that's in there too. Bands like Primetime, Ornette Coleman's band, 70s Miles. So a lot of it on its surface is outside jazz, but at this point what jazz has kind of morphed into and all the different sub-genres within jazz, I think it's kind of it fits in with the rest of what I do as a composer and what I do as a bass player as well. But yeah, definitely it was mixed with definitely not mixed with a traditional jazz sensibility, not produced with a traditional jazz sensibility. Ron St. Germain, who recorded and mixed that album, and he also mixed the Superette album, is well known in both the rock and jazz worlds, but
Sure,
definitely more in the rock world.
yeah.
And I just wanted it to have a sound that kind of reflected that sort of big rock sensibility, not in like, arena rock or anything like that, but
No, no.
I didn't want it to be limited to like a sort of sterile, boxy, the way a lot of modern jazz records are made now with like no reverb. I wanted it to, sound like a group. I wanted the music to sound unified and with the guitar, it just kind of lent itself to that sort of approach.
But the actual writing, was it, you know, not
Oh,
was it the
right.
typical sort of heads and solos jazz composition, I guess, wouldn't work in this kind of instrumental rock format. So did you find yourself writing riffs and bridges and, you know, things like rock song elements, sort of?
Yeah, but I did, but I was already running that way with Big Mouth. So it for me it wasn't a big departure compositionally. I don't really write in terms of head solo head. I try to think in terms of more modular things, and sometimes I'll come up with a piece of music, a piece of material that I'll just have us play and just see what happens and see what it leads to. I have a bunch of different approaches that I use, but if you listen to a song like Light Trails on that record, it's not really that much of a departure from some of the stuff I've done on the last couple Big Mouth records. It's sort of got this floating melody with a groove underneath, and the two things don't necessarily lock up with each other, but there's a harmonic structure, but we're also kind of playing freely with the harmonic structure. That's kind of like about five or six songs that I've had on Big Mouth records as well. But without the saxophones, suddenly a lot of people, and myself included, I was like, wow, this really is a rock album.
And I mean, it doesn't hurt that you're covering a Link Wray song, which it took me a minute because I was listening to the album and I got to that track, Ace of Spades, and about halfway through it, I was like, this is a really interesting sort of like, it feels like they're playing off Rumble, And so then I look at the title, Ace of Spades, I'm like, let me go look. And I pulled up Link Wray on Spotify and figured out that it was a cover song. But then I was like, wow, this is like a really interesting sort of homage to Rumble. And then I was like, oh no, it's an actual Link Wray song.
I'm a huge Link Wray. I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan. It's not like I have a million of his records, but I love his music. I love his guitar playing. I think he's one of the most important guitar players of the 20th century. I mean, he influenced every guitar player that came after him. In, I mean, every rock guitar player for sure. I mean, he was the, there'd be no Pete Townsend without him. I mean, I think he and Chuck Berry are probably the two most important rock and roll guitar players, unless you want to go back as far as Robert Johnson or something like that,
No, it's
and Hendrix, of course. But there, he was an influence on Hendrix too. And what's amazing about, well, that piece and that song, my cousin is a rock guitar player. I mean, he's a composer. He does a lot of different stuff. But he was the one who kind of told me about him, and when I went out and checked out his music at the time, I realized, oh, he's the one who did this song, Rumble, that everybody knows because it was in, the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, but I knew it from before that. And it was, and I looked, did some research on it, realized it was a top 10 hit, I think, or at least a top 20. It was like a jukebox hit. And when you listen to that song, it's, you read stories about the early days of rock and roll, like in the 50s, and how all these suburban parents were worried that, rock and roll was going to come and brainwash their kids and turn them into drug-addled, lunatics, and all, steal their daughters away and whatever, turn them into whatever bad people. And it seems so silly when you actually hear early rock and roll, people like Little Richard and Chuck Berry. It's just such happy, good time, just good fun music, by today's standards. But when you listen to Rumble, you hear that and you think, oh, I totally hear why people would be scared of this music.
There's a
It's so ominous. It's really scary music. And I talked about it with some friends of mine, and they're like, yeah, totally. It still sounds completely otherworldly and just scary, and but in an incredibly cool, awesome way. And I think you did Ace of Spades a couple years later. And I loved how he, on the original version of Ace of Spades, he phrases those three chords so freely, and it reminded me of some of my favorite free jazz guitar players, like Sonny Chirac. And
Some of those guys were really out. I mean, I remember listening to Chuck Berry, okay, and then listening to Billy Zoom from the band X, and realizing that while Billy Zoom was like completely ripping off Chuck Berry, his style, even though Billy Zoom was in a quote unquote punk band, his style was actually cleaner than Chuck Berry's.
Oh, Chuck Berry was avant-garde.
Yeah, he was this completely wild ass guitar player.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll?
I've seen clips, yeah.
That is just one of my favorite documentaries. It's got to be one of the greatest documentaries of all time. And the when they finally get to the final concert at the end, and you hear the way he plays and the way he phrases his singing, I didn't realize how heavy he was. He's so incredible, and he's light years beyond everyone else on the stage with him. You know, like as a musician, he's and they can't keep up with him. I mean, Keith Richards certainly can't keep up with him, but he's just completely, he owns that stage, he owns that whole concert, and he's so spontaneous. Like, and they talk about how he just like switch keys in the middle of songs and no one can follow.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, when we did the Link Race song, I wanted to kind of extend those chords even more and kind of have that be like the folk. If we were going to do an arrangement based on it, not have it just be a complete, you know, straight cover, which I didn't want to do. I wanted to sort of almost exaggerate that aspect of it.
Yeah.
So when we stretch out the chords, we stretch them out even more. And but what's so funny is that if you go back, if you could check out YouTube clips of Link Ray doing the song, he did the opposite as he got older. He just kind of hits the chords completely straight in time. Talk about punk rock. I mean, it is, he to me exemplified the punk rock ethos probably better than anybody. Till the day he died. If you just watch any of those clips of him playing, he was so hardcore. And you know, he's the inventor of rock guitar playing. So.
So you play bass guitar with Superette as opposed to upright.
Yes.
Did you start out as a bass guitarist?
I did. I started playing. I was a violinist from starting at age 9. And while I was still playing violin, I started kind of playing bass guitar on the side when I was 14. And I had just switched to a new school, and I met a bunch of guys my age who played guitar and drums and stuff and keyboards. And we started these, you know, garage bands basically, in different parents' basements. And that's how I started playing bass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my other cousin, the guitar player's brother, had a Fender Precision that he lent me till I could, you know, save up enough lawn mowing money to buy my own. And that was how I got my start playing bass. And then getting more and more into that, I got more and more into the bass. I was never really that into the violin. I was playing in the local youth symphony, and my parents had to force me to practice. But once I started playing bass guitar, they couldn't get me to stop practicing. So, and I got more and more into it, the instrument, and started checking out more and more music, but kind of sort of through the lens of the bass guitar, and you know, doing research on it and buying, you know, nerdy guitar magazines and learning about people like Stanley Clarke and Jaco, and that's how I got into jazz.
Uh-huh.
Which is a pretty common progression, especially among, again, guys around my age who started playing bass guitar. I talked to a lot of other people, and they're like, yeah, I got into, you know, Yes, and then Weather Report, and then Miles, and then I started playing upright. And that was kind of the same thing with me.
Yeah. It's interesting. I recently had Jamaluddin Takuma on the podcast.
Oh, I love Jamal.
And
so great.
One of the things that we talked about was that, you know, early on when he was with Ornette, he was playing I believe a Rickenbacker, which was the same, you know, the Chris Squire bass.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moved into like Steinberger, you know, the little tiny mm-hmm. Steinberger that he played in the 80s and stuff like that.
So it was kind of his signature in
the 80s. Yeah. And I'm curious because I've never asked anybody about this. Is there a similar, because they have very different sounds, you know, those type of basses. I mean, you know, that's the big Rickenbacker is how you get like the Lemmy from Motorhead sound, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever. And I'm curious whether there's a similar differentiation between uprights. Like, are there different uprights that have radically different sounds that way?
It's not as, well, uprights do sound radically different from each other, and probably even more radically different from each other than electric basses even do. It's not as consistent when, you know, first of all, like, I don't even have a branded upright bass. My upright bass is 100 years old. It's a German bass. I don't know who made it, so I can't even tell you what kind of bass it is, except for that it's an old German trade bass. But I could find another bass player who has a bass that looks identical to mine. It might have, we could surmise, came out of the same factory.
Mm-hmm.
That won't sound anything like my bass at all, like not even close.
Huh.
Whereas if you take two Rickenbacker basses made in the 70s, you and set them up, the same way with the same kind of strings, they might sound different from each other, but they're not going to sound completely radically different from each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, there's a lot less of that kind of correlation. Because there's, you know, less of a brand thing. I mean, and then when you get into like the really great, really, really expensive, valuable, famous makers from like the 17 and 1800s, those instruments have all undergone so many different transformations. And everybody who has the instrument, they might own the instrument for 40 years. They'll have all sorts of work and changes done to it over time. And you can make generalizations, like a flat back upright bass will project better than a round back one, which will have a fuller sound than a flat back, you know, mm-hmm. Things like that. You can get, and we could get really esoteric if you wanted to. I don't know how much your listeners want to hear about this, but it's, I think it's a lot less of a correlation with regard to any kind of branding thing.
Yeah. So with an upright, you really are kind of struggling with/against the instrument in order to come up with your own sort of voice on it.
Yeah, but then there's that thing where like the same bass player will sound very, will play different basses than you can tell it's them.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with piano players, like Monk always sounded like Monk when he played different pianos.
In
terms of dealing with the actual instrument that you have, I have found that the more I can get my instrument to work for me, and that's usually through getting it set up correctly and repaired correctly, obviously the better. It helps a lot.
Yeah.
And it's unfair because the young students who get started, who come from backgrounds that can afford to get them a nice instrument, have a really, really huge advantage over someone who, you know, is playing a school instrument that's never been set up properly. That's true of any instrument, but I think on bass it's especially tough. I remember I just started playing upright bass, and I borrowed a bass from a school, and it was actually not a bad bass. It was a K plywood bass that a friend of mine that played in the youth symphony with me had been using. And my mom called the school up and said, my son wants to start playing bass, could we rent it from you? And they agreed to rent it to us for a year for $100,
which, wow, was,
even in the 80s, that was a pretty good deal. And then my friend graduated to his own bass that his parents, I think, bought for him as a graduation present. And then at one point at my senior year, this is when I got really serious about starting to study double bass, my band director said, oh, we just got an upright bass. And I said, oh, cool. So I went and I checked it out, and I couldn't play it at all. It was a brand new bass. I think it was made in the US, but it was unplayable. You know, it needed to be set up by an actual luthier, you know, that came straight from the factory. And it was basically in the current form, you know, not really useful at all.
Yeah.
And I think, and I always think, you know, how many students didn't even have the benefit of having a parent who at a school that had a bass that they knew was sort of ready to play, a good starter instrument, you know, even if it was a plywood bass, and be willing to pay $100 to rent for their kid, you know, it's not a level playing field for students who want to get started out.
Exactly.
On any instrument, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, a Rickenbacker can sound like, it can sound like Chris Squire or Geddy Lee, but it can also sound like Paul McCartney, who also played a Rickenbacker on, you know, everything from Rubber Soul. And he got the opposite sound of those guys. He got this deep, fat tone. And the same instrument in the hands of someone like Chris Squire got this really incredibly bright, almost like guitar type tone.
Yeah. And then there's this incredible YouTube clip of Lemmy demonstrating his sound you know, on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's hilarious because it's like,
I'm
he's like,
check that out.
Yeah, he's like, most players, you know, they sound like this, and it's just a boom, 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 and then he, you know, stomps on the pedal, and it's just, you get that Motorhead roar.
Right. Yeah, I think John Entwistle something similar.
Mm-hmm.
When he'd be explaining his tone concept, he's like, this is a bass player, and he'd, you know, play something like that. So, okay, here's a bass guitarist, and he'd, you know, hit some switch.
Yeah. So you first popped up on my radar as about 20 years ago, I guess now, as a member of Joe Morris's quartet and Whit Dickey's trio. So what was your like entry point into that sort of New York free jazz scene, and what kind of challenges did playing that music present as a relatively young player?
Well, that's a good question. My introduction to Joe and Whit was through Rob Brown, the great alto saxophonist, who I met through. I think I met him through Susie Ibarra and Asif Sahar.
Oh, okay, sure.
At the time, tenor player. And
wait, were you in their trio as well?
No, but I played a lot with them. We did a lot of sessions.
Okay.
It was interesting. You know, when I moved to New York, there was the bebop scene, and there was the Ninny Factory, which was kind of like eclectic and integrated. But then there was the sort of Lower East Side free jazz world, which was centered around Context Studios at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Where William and Patricia Parker were just starting to present. Well, I guess they'd been doing it for a while, but they had kind of set up this improvisers collective. And it was cool because I could go to, you know, jam sessions. I mean, I moved to New York in the early 90s. I didn't literally knew maybe one musician. So I would go out and try to meet musicians, and I would go to jam sessions, bebop jam sessions, wherever I could. But they also had these free jazz jam sessions over there, and I was into all of it. And that's how I met Susie and Asif, I think, through one of those concerts. I might have met them after they played with William Parker's big band one time.
Okay.
The Baby Huey Orchestra, Little Huey Orchestra.
Yeah.
And so through them, I think I met Rob, and then through Rob, I think Joe Morris came to hear me play a show with Rob Brown and an alto saxophonist named Chris Jonas. And then Rob and I recorded Whit Dickey's trio record, and Joe heard that. And I think on the basis of that, he started calling me to do stuff, and I joined his quartet shortly after that. And for me, that was just music that I wanted. I mean, I kind of thought that world out when I moved to New York because I loved that particular, I mean, I loved, you know, people like Cecil Taylor and Albert Eiler, whose music I got into probably after I got into Ornette Coleman's music. And I had studied with Ed Blackwell when I was at Wesleyan for one semester. And it just was a natural progression of events to start playing with guys like that.
Yeah.
In addition to all the other gigs I was doing, which was, you know, much more straight ahead at the time. Lots of you know, restaurant gigs playing standards, lots of trio gigs with tenor saxophonists and drummers playing standards, and just wherever people got gigs. And that's how I met people like Tony Malaby and Chris Cheek, and how my first quartet eventually happened, which is kind of what Big Mouth came out of.
Yeah. Now, I've had Whit Dickey on this podcast, and I know he's really not interested in conventional time at all. So can you talk about what that brought out of you as his bassist? Because you kind of really had to be the foundation, I would guess. Because I remember he was telling me that when he was in David Ware's quartet, that William used to get really mad at him because William Parker would get really mad at him because Matt Shipp would be going all the way out, David Ware would be going all the way out, Whit would be going all the way out, and William had to, like, hold everything together. So was that your role in Whit's trio as well?
I didn't really feel it as such. I mean, part of the reason that I started playing bass is that I like the kind of role that the bass does well. It doesn't mean that I have to do that all the time. I like taking solos. I like improvising as freely as a lot of other people like to do. I like doing experimenting with all sorts of different sounds and just playing with people when wherever that takes me. And but the tradition, but, you know, having some sort of supportive role in the bass feels really good to me. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I have to play with a drummer who plays straight time. It doesn't mean I'm playing straight time either. I mean, rhythmically, that music comes out of it, it's still rhythm. It doesn't hook up in a traditional way like it does when you're playing with a drummer who's, you know, playing time on the ride cymbal. But just like there's an infinite number of ways to play time with a drummer who's playing time on the ride cymbal, who's swinging, and you know, literally every single drummer has a different way of doing it, and I feel the pulse differently and play differently with every single drummer because of the way our sounds combine. That music can be approached any number of ways. And I never really got caught up in worrying about, who's got the time, or it never was about that for me. I mean, sometimes it would go into time and sometimes it wouldn't. And sometimes it does continue to. But I never got hung up on it. And I don't remember feeling that way when I was playing with, but I didn't play with it as much as William did. you know, I did a bunch of records with Witt, and we've done a few gigs, but I never went on tour with him. I love Witt's writing and I love Witt's playing. I think he's great. And I hear it. I'm actually kind of surprised to hear that he said that, because I hear a lot of rhythm in Witt's playing. It's not just, you know, a wash of sound or texture. I mean, he's a very rhythmic player to me. And one time I remember playing a gig with him, with Rob actually, where he went into this really deep, I mean, it's surprising because it was very different from something he had done, but anything he'd done before, this really deep groove. And I was like, man, what is that? It sounded almost like some New Orleans stuff, but it was really off kilter at the same time. It sounded like him, but playing this great groove, and it was otherworldly and just felt amazing. And after it was over, I was like, wait, well, that was amazing. He said, oh yeah, I was trying out my Freddie Waits stuff. So I meant to ask him what record was the point of reference for that, but it was probably a Bill Dixon record. I think.
Yeah, that was one of the things that he and I spoke about, was how when he was at Bennington, he studied with both Bill Dixon and Milford Graves, who are kind of two poles in terms of creative expression, you know. And right. So and it's like, how Bill do you Dixon, I, how do yeah. you take away something meaningful from both of them? You know, it mm-hmm. almost seems like you would have to choose, but he didn't, you know.
Right. I mean, that's the way I went to Williams, which is 20 minutes from Bennington, and I actually took Bill's class my senior year. I drove up with a trumpet player and we took Bill's class together. And I'd been told about the politics of the scene and those guys weren't speaking to each other. And so I never really got inside any of that stuff. So I couldn't speak to any of that.
Well, but I mean, even beyond scene politics, like if you just listen to what Dixon does creatively versus what Milford does creatively, like Dixon is like, you know, one note can express everything you want to say, and mm-hmm. Milford is like, let's hit everything three times, you know?
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that I don't hear that as being mutually exclusive, and I think Witt probably didn't either. You know, it just, I think that the problem Milford and Bill might have been that they just, you know, couldn't get along and they didn't want to play with each other. But I don't think, you know, I'm just, because you love Milford's music doesn't mean you can't love Bill's as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think, and I'm as much as it would have been so amazing to be up there at that time and studying with both of those guys, it must have been awkward.
Yeah. So the Joe Morris Quartet was basically like a string trio with a drummer. So tell me about finding your place in that music, where there's so much more sort of harmony going on.
Yeah, I felt it not as a string trio with a drummer. It was a quartet. It was four people playing music together as a quartet. And I felt like I was playing as part of a rhythm section as much as I was playing as part of a string trio. You know, when I first joined the band, it was with Jerome Dupree on drums, the Cloud of Blackbirds record. And then Gerald joined right around the time that I met Gerald. I actually recommended Gerald for the band. And Gerald and I really clicked musically right away. He was doing on the drums a lot of the things that I was trying to do on the bass. In terms of like the range of music that I wanted to be playing, I loved playing with people who were into, you know, doing more creative stuff and more experimental things. And I loved playing straight ahead. I loved playing grooves. I wanted to, and that's what I loved about Ornette Coleman's music, because it combined all that. Gerald was the first drummer that I met who really had that beat and didn't get hung up on, oh, are we playing straight ahead or are we playing free? No, we're just playing music. And within the context of Joe's music, he seemed, when Joe needed to get a new drummer, because Jerome was going on the road with Morphine again, which he had been in the original band, the original version of Morphine. He went on the road with them and he wasn't available. So he said, I need a new drummer. I said, Gerald is, you're going to love Gerald's playing. And because I heard a lot of that in Joe's music, Joe was already doing that as well. But I think Gerald was really the perfect drummer for that approach. Cause Joe uses, he's an incredible free improviser, but he also likes rhythm. He likes time. He likes structure. He likes playing with those things. He likes juxtaposing things. And Gerald does that in his playing already.
Joe naturally, is super open to basically anything, you know.
Joe, you said Joe or Gerald? And Gerald is too. I mean, he's a very like-minded person. And Gerald, as a drummer, the drummer has the ability to really allow things to happen. I mean, we all do, but if the drummer's not allowing it, it kind of makes it challenging. With Gerald, he and I started working together in so many different bands. After that point, I formed a band with him. He formed a band with me. We did records with Joe, with Craig Taborn. Basically, we did about a dozen records over the next few years. Right after that, like a couple years after we met, and whether we were playing with on Ben Walter's record, which was a much more straight ahead thing, or we were playing with someone like Rob Brown, it had that feeling of openness and had that feeling of earthy musicality, because he's got all of that in his playing. And there's very few drummers out there that did that. Well, they speak at that time of that generation. It was, like I said, the scene was so much more segregated. And, you know, one of the few people that came to mind who was already doing that, who was much older, was someone like Andrew Cyrille.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was a big part of my relationship to the group, was in terms of my relationship with the other musicians, and Gerald was a big part of that.
Yeah.
And when that happened, it allowed the string aspect of it to really come to the forefront more. It allowed Joe and Matt the freedom to sort of like combine their sounds in new ways. And I think of the records we did with him at that time, maybe the Old Office record maybe typifies that the most.
Weeps out at me, yeah.
Yeah, the Under Through album was cool, but that was the first one with Gerald, and we basically just went to the studio and played all that music kind of for the first time after maybe doing one gig. So it was nice to have a reunion when we did the Balance record a couple years ago and do a tour, because that was that same quartet, and see how much we've evolved since then.
Because
we hadn't really played together in the interim since around the time of the Old Office record.
Not the four of you, yeah, because I know Gerald about 10 were years.
Gerald and I were working a lot, but the quartet hadn't, yeah.
So let me just jump forward, because I want to ask about Super Big Mouth, which is the combination of Superette and Big Mouth with all the collective personnel. So tell me about the genesis of this idea.
So as soon as I put Superette together, and before I even was done writing music for them, I started thinking, oh, it'd be good to put the two bands together. I don't know why. I just had this inkling to do that. Usually, you know, when I put the quartet, when I started with the quartet, I was thinking very practically. I had two tenor saxophones, bass and drums, super portable. We can get in a car. We can play all over the city. We don't need a piano. And then Craig and I started playing together. And I was like, well, I really want to put Craig in the band. So I was like, okay, well, we'll put Craig in the band. And even if we don't have piano, we'll have him play Wurlitzer. And I love Craig on Wurlitzer. And Craig loves to play Wurlitzer. But then I started writing with piano in mind. And like, okay, well, we need a piano. And so that became a quintet. That became a little harder to book and, you know, finagle. Then Superette was sort of like a return to the practical side of things, but then Super Big Mouth, it's all the practicalities just out the door. We got two drummers, two guitars, two tenor saxophones, and Craig on like five different keyboards. I just kept thinking the guitars and the tenor saxophones together are going to sound so cool. I got to try this. I didn't know what the music was going to be like. And so I had an opportunity to write and record through a couple of grants that I'd gotten through Chamber Music America and the Shifting Foundation. And I decided, well, this is the project that I should do, because I'm never going to get a chance to do something like this. I mean, I might not get a chance to do something on this kind of scale again, where I'm going to get the recording budget, et cetera, for it. So when I started writing, I was thinking about the music we had done with Superette, and it was weird because I was in the middle of recording the Superette album as I was writing some of the Super Big Mouth music. Mm-hmm. And I actually went back and wrote some Superette stuff. I took a break from the Super Big Mouth music to write some new pieces for the Super Big Mouth, for the Superette record. God, this gets so confusing. because we had decided to add Medeski and Nels to the recording, and Nels Klein to the recording, and so I wanted to write some pieces with them in mind. So I went back and wrote a couple new things for the Superette album. Uh-huh. And then when I came back, I found that those decisions kind of started to inform some of the decisions that I was making with Super Big Mouth. And I think that the writing, what I was hearing was just I was listening to a lot of classical music, a lot of Bach around that time, and so I think a lot of the counterpoint of that started seeping into my writing.
See, it's interesting because I was going to ask you about the writing, because again, the music is neither jazz nor rock. It's this instrumental music that falls somewhere in between, and there are kind of a lot of the pieces have these like long melody lines. Mm-hmm. And to me, it sounded like prog. You know, it sounded like 70s prog. And so when you say Bach, I'm like, all right, I can connect directly from that to Yes, you know. Mm. So that's kind of, you know, like I can hear the, you know, Baroque music going into like Yes and Genesis and, you know, groups like Return to Forever that people don't usually think of as prog. But to me, they're an instrumental prog group, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I love Yes. I wasn't directly trying to be in, like, that wasn't my approach so much. I wasn't going for a prog approach, but if you hear that, that's cool. I was hearing a bit, although I was listening to the classical music, I also listened to a lot of different pop music, and I think that's a thread that kind of runs through the Big Mouth repertoire too, where I'm trying to imbue it with a sort of melodic pop sensibility. And there's another musician that I discovered recently that I think was an influence on my writing process, named David Axelrod. Have you ever checked him out?
I know the stuff that he did with Cannonball Adderley.
Right. So he, after he did the Cannonball Adderley records, and I think Lou Rawls albums, around that same time for Capitol, Capitol Records basically gave him carte blanche to go in and do his own stuff. And he produced... he produced a couple things for the Electric Prunes, one of which had the song Holy Are You, which was in the Easy Rider soundtrack. And then and it was all this music that almost sounded like garage mixed with liturgical stuff, with like these almost choir-like structures. And then he, you know, on his own, he did, it was all instrumental, using mostly Wrecking Crew musicians like Carol Kay and Earl Palmer. And it was stuff with strings and horns. And he had these, there was a lot of these just kind of like wide open spaces and long melodies, kind of simple, but also with these big block chords. And I think a lot of that seeped into my writing as well.
Oh.
So, and that's part of, I think, why, like, the second track, 0.5, that's why we ended up doing kind of like a bigger reverb sound on that one, because that is, was especially kind of influenced by that. And a lot of other pop music I was listening to at the time, like, I was listening to a lot of Scott Walker and the Walker Brothers, and just sort of like Phil Spector style productions.
Yeah, it definitely has like a big sound. I mean, tell me about the actual recording. Like, is it difficult to find a studio in New York that can accommodate a group with two drummers?
Well, we luckily I used the Brooklyn recording, the engineer Andy Taub, who did the last two Big Mouth records, who I knew really well. I've done a lot of records there with him over the years, mostly as a sideman, but I did the two Big Mouth albums there. He and I have a really good working relationship. He's an amazing studio with a lot of great instruments. And I knew that I wanted Craig to play a bunch of different organs on this album. Because
mm-hmm.
Craig and his quartet that he's been doing with me and Dave King and Chris Speed has been playing a lot of Farfisa and Vox organs in the context of that music. And I, hearing him, the way he deals with that sort of sound, I knew that I wanted him to play at least some organ, and he ended up doing sort of 75% organ on the record. The rest is piano and a little bit of Wurlitzer, electric piano. But so that was sort of like one of my first considerations, was making sure we had a place that would have these different keyboard instruments that Craig was going to need. And then Andy worked out a way to configure the two drummers in the same room to give them a natural blend, so we weren't like forced to recreate a room sound completely mm-hmm. and have the whole thing be artificial. So we had room mics set up a certain way, and he had the two drummers in the main tracking room along with me and the two guitar players, and Craig, and then he only had to isolate amplifiers and the two tenor saxophonists who were in their own booth.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was it did take some preparation, and Andy really, really hooked it up. It wasn't just a thing where we showed up that morning and he's like, okay, what do you want to do? Like, he called me ahead of time. He had me come over the day before, and he had everything set up. He was really great. So then when it came time to mix it later with Saint, you know, there was already sort of a natural room sound happening, especially with regard to the drummers, because I knew that the drum sound really is the thing that makes or breaks an album for me, especially jazz albums when you have a lot of cymbals. If it sounds too boxed in with the drums, it can affect everything.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that there was an openness to what they were doing for when we mixed it later.
Yeah. It's interesting because I remember... Are you familiar with the Melvins?
Sure.
For a while, they had a two-drummer lineup, which I think was their best lineup. And it was mm-hmm. really interesting because I saw some video of that band performing, and the two kits were sort of lined up at an angle to each other on the stage, and they actually had one giant floor tom that they shared between them. That was like right in between the two kits. It was insane to watch these guys play because it really turned into... almost like a drum core kind of a thing.
I might have to steal that for Super Big Mouth when we do our record release. Maybe for Space Alone that would make sense. Just okay, guys, one floor tom.
Yeah. And I, by the way, I really like the diagram inside the CD cover that shows how everything is mixed on album. It's because with
Thank
this many
you.
Instruments, the mix is like super important, you know, to keep everybody clear.
Right. I mean, that was I thought long and hard about whether I was going to do that or not, and there were, at one point there was a issue as to whether it could happen or not, and I kind of fought for it a little bit. So I'm glad you appreciated that. It's sort of an homage. The whole design concept is sort of an homage to like those '60s, almost like bachelor pad percussion albums where you show off your stereo. I don't
know
if you've ever seen any of those.
Yeah.
Like Command Records did a lot of them. I'm sort of a record nerd. And my dad had a bunch of these old percussion albums in his collection that I used to listen to when I started really getting into music in high school, and I started going through his collection. And I always loved those covers because they had these sort of gestalt, you know, design, really simple things. And they often would have these, you know, diagrams of the stereo field, the way they work. And so that was sort of a tribute to that.
Yeah. I read something else interesting last week. I have not heard the album yet because I'm not a huge fan, but I find it interesting. Somebody was talking about the new Tool record actually pans the drums from left to right as though the listener is sitting behind the kit, rather than from right to left as though the listener is standing in front of the kit, which is standard mixing practice.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it's weird. I've personally had I just got a stereo, a proper system set up in my house for the first time in a long time. I was listening to, had a pretty bad listening situation for a while, listening either on, you know, earbuds or phones or on these little studio monitors that I use for my computer. And I've been noticing that the way people mix drums can make or break the whole mix. And I've come to the conclusion that mixing the drums, and I had a lot of records where I did this because it's just sort of just the default mode. Mixing drums, whether it's in front of or behind the kit, you don't necessarily want to do that. It doesn't necessarily make for a great sounding record to have the drums panned from left to right. The old Blue Note approach, where you have the drums on the right side, it sounds, when you actually have the stereo set up correctly, it sounds like you're listening to a band on stage.
Yeah.
When you have the drums panned from left to right, and then you have, you know, the saxophone in the middle and the bass in the middle and the piano in the middle, or whatever, the piano panned from left to right, if it's not done really well, it can sound like, okay, you got a cymbal player on one side and a hi-hat player on the other and a bass drum player in the middle. It becomes completely disjointed, and it might have something to do with the way my system is set up, because, you know, it's not like super high end or anything. But I've been thinking a lot about the drum panning thing, and this is the first time where I've actually put the drums on one side or the other, because I had two drummers and I had to put them on one side or the other. I didn't have one drummer where I'd put the whole thing panned left to right.
Yeah.
But you haven't heard the Tool record though, right?
No, because I know it exists, but I'm not a huge fan, so I'm just kind of like, you know, other things are getting in the way. There was
so much to listen to.
There was another record that I thought came up with a really ingenious solution. There's this band called Disfear, Disfear, from Sweden. Mm-hmm. They're like a hardcore punk/metal band, and the producer, Kurt Ballou, actually mixed the drums in mono and put them right in the center of the mix, and then everything else is stereo, but it's this absolutely blasting drum sound.
Wow. I'd love to hear that. I'm very intrigued to hear that.
Yeah, it's, you don't notice it at first, and then when you read somewhere online that that's what he did, you're like, oh, wow, that's why that sounds like I'm being jackhammered in the skull.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, it's one thing to mix it in mono and put it on one side or the other.
Yeah, but no, he just planted it in the middle.
Yeah. I'm trying to envision what that would sound like. So, the other thing is the pianos, the way they used to do pianos in the old days, they would record the piano in mono, and they would either put the piano in the center or the right or the left, and it would give it a kind of that boxy kind of mid-rangey sound that people sometimes get on. They complain about, again, Rudy Van Gelder, the way he recorded piano, but it would give it a really good place in the mix.
Yeah, I would imagine if you were a piano player, you would hate it. But as a listener, I'm addicted to that primitive
Columbia
Van Gelder
like
sound.
Columbia Miles records were the same way. The piano was always in mono. It became a thing more in the 70s. I think it was sort of like a post-ECM approach, maybe, where everything, the piano, the drums, everything became stereo. And sometimes it sounds absolutely gorgeous, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily the way to go. And I think for my next record, I'm going to, That's one thing I might approach doing differently. Is I'm just gonna at least while we're mixing it, see what it would feel like to have the drums on one side. Not all, but you can't pan it too far. You got to do it sort of so it's natural, you know. And back in the old days, they couldn't pan stuff. They could only have something hard right, hard left, or center. So it was all about the room placement.
So you mentioned a record release show. Do you think you're going to be able to play live much with this band? Like, do you, are you reaching out to like festivals and stuff to get bookings?
I'm reaching out live. I don't, doesn't mean it's going to happen, but I'm making a valiant effort. there's a couple festivals that are interested. It's just a matter of whether it's going to be able to happen or not. So we'll see. And for people who are interested in seeing this band live, you can check my website for dates as they're updated. But yeah, I mean, I'm going into this fully hoping to share this music as much as I possibly can. It's probably not the kind of band that's going to be able to do a 3-week tour though.
No. Yeah. And so, and then it's coming out on Pyroclastic, which is Chris Davis's label. So,
right.
And you mentioned earlier that a lot of it was grant funded. So can you, just for other musicians who might be listening to this, can you talk a little bit about the financing process and maybe if you even want to go into detail about what it costs to make and stuff like that, like that might be helpful to someone.
Well, I don't even know how much it costs to make, so I couldn't even answer that. It did. But I do know that I was very lucky to get the funding that I got. I personally couldn't have done this record without it. So I'm fully aware of how fortunate I was to have this as an opportunity. It is a reality that, you know, whether it's through grant funding or crowd funding, that most musicians I know are turning to alternative forms of funding their projects. I've had to sink a lot of my own money from my earnings as a sideman into my projects in the past as well. Without getting into specifics of what stuff costs, which I'm not really comfortable talking about,
right?
And again, I don't even know offhand. It is a reality, and you know, I'm fortunate. I have sunk my own music into my own projects in the past, and my first record was on a Spanish label, Fresh Sound, and I was given a budget for that record and for actually two records. And it was kind of amazing in retrospect that there was ever a time where an independent label could give you a budget to do a record.
Yeah. Nowadays they just kind of go, do you have something you want to put out or something?
Right. They're like, where's your mastered album, please? I will put it out now. And yeah, this was like, and so I feel again, doubly fortunate that I even got to experience that at all. Most musicians, when they move to New York, already have a couple albums that they've just been done just to have almost as calling cards as players and not just as band leaders, just as players so people can check out their music. It's a very different thing. I didn't do my own record until I'd been sort of working in New York for about 7 years. And it's not uncommon now for bass players to have records like it was then. That was part of the reason I didn't do it. I just didn't even think it was something that a bass player did at the time. But the cool thing for me was that I didn't really. I took seven in that 7 years. I feel like I sort of had grown enough and had a. At least a concept of what I wanted to say as a composer a little bit and as a band leader and what kind of band I wanted to put together. If I had tried to do that when I was 22 years old versus almost 30 when I did my first record, I don't think it would have been worth putting out. So having that time was a luxury as well. Not having to like produce something, but when I'm teaching now, like when I go to the new school and I work with younger musicians, it's amazing the level of writing and conceptual acumen that these students have now, that the kind of listening they do and the kind of absorption that they have for musics and just the way they kind of synthesize things. I'm very impressed with it. And I think part of it has been out of necessity, because people are expected to sort of like have something like that, like almost like a brand musically, like to be able to present to people, like a sensibility.
Yeah, yeah. It's not, I mean, I remember late 90s, early 2000s, like when you were talking about, you know, meeting Asif and Susie and, you know, people like that. Like, I remember hearing, you know, there was a time when you would hear somebody's first album and you could, like, close your eyes and picture their record collection. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's as true anymore. You know, you don't get somebody that's just coming in and is doing, like, a straight Eiler thing or whatever. You know, you don't get records, or you don't get people who are coming in, you know, too early now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I think people just, it's not even that common to have a record collection, period. I mean, like, I can picture their streaming, their Spotify weekly playlist recommendations or whatever, you know. It's not quite the same thing.
Okay, that was my conversation with Chris Lightcap, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the website and the show. Subscribers are now getting exclusive articles, in fact, something I've been talking about doing for a while, so visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.